Good evening, and welcome to Call Out, Protest, Speak Back. Welcome to our third keynote event for this year's festival edition, and we would like to warmly thank the Bundeszentrale für politische Bildung for their support to the conference program. This year in the conference of Transmediale 2018, we took the politics and the economy of face value as a starting point in order to address and highlight the relations of capitalism to racism and of neoliberalism to fascism, specifically locating the role that media and technological systems play in the contemporary alarming formations. We aim to locate and look into related processes and phenomena, but also to reflect upon much-needed synergies and forms of coalition. The main issues tackled in this year's conference are not new. They are old, recurrent. They are questions that the so-called post-race period wanted us to forget that they exist. Especially the internet was meant to be the place where race and gender would no longer matter. But of course, this was never the case. On the contrary, as Lisa Nakamura, our very special guest and keynote speaker for this evening, underlined already in 2002, the internet was and is the space where race happens, and it happens in order to be seen and to be consumed. So what we're still in need of, difficult as it may be, are non-sexist and non-racist communication spaces that would respectively point to a different way of thinking, acting, and being. And what we need to underline more is the role of the ones, the actors, the users, that, as the title of this event has it, with their practices and strategies, call out today's racial and sexist violence, protest and formulate ways of speaking back. The keynote tonight will be introduced and moderated by Nishan Shah. Nishan is the Dean of Graduate School at the Artes University of the Arts in the Netherlands. He's a visiting professor at the Center for Digital Cultures at Leuphana University and the co-founder of the Center for Internet and Society in India. Nishan's interests lie in the intersection of radical humanism, social identities, and digital technologies. He has worked on issues of representation and on online violence, specifically looking into web shaming and selfie shaming. In his most recent research, Nishan is interested in how the new racial network capitalism might be actually raising the face and privileging the interface. Please join me in welcoming Nishan Shah and our keynote speaker, Lisa Nakamura. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Good evening, everyone. It is such a pleasure and a privilege to host today's keynote. It's also slightly unnerving and a little bit scary. Because I'm, for the first time, hosting somebody who, in my own academic career, I had thought of as a hero for more than a decade. I was a grad student when I first read Lisa Nakamura's work, where she introduced the idea of the second shift and the invisible labor that women perform in everyday work and social environments, and looking at the ways in which techno-socialities, right, which through the seduction of visualization and erasure of bodies, continue to form, inform, and formulate new conditions of labor and exploitations of specific groups of people, but especially women of color. Since that first introduction into thinking about bodies as technologies, technologies as embodied, and politics of invisibility that get naturalized into the scripts of global production and consumption of digitality, Dr. Nakamura's work has been a cornerstone for me to think through. Over the years, her framework of thinking through the biotechnical turn, the technological, techno-biological turn, and the technogenetic turn that signals a cultural, institutional, and scholarly transformation that privileges digital technological forms of knowledge, mediation and interaction has been a source of thinking through contemporary change practices for students in my classrooms. For today's talk, Dr. Nakamura concentrates on the contemporary moment of breaking through the techno-social, post-national, post-racial silence, which has been embodied in the seemingly global protests of gendered and racial rights. Looking at historical production of technologies, the structural critique from feminist and racial politics, and the need for a politics of hope, where we don't only think about what we fight against, but necessarily what we fight for is a message that I take away from it. Her keynote today gives us not only a reference, but also a way for, not only a framework, right, but also a way forward within the discursive nature of many of these events. So I don't want to preempt the keynote, but I do want to draw upon perhaps two specific examples that might be small footnotes to the larger ideas of speech, protest, and call-out cultures, and might hopefully give us some questions that we can come back to in the discussions at the end of the talk. So I particularly want to pose for you two forms of digital cultural production and consumption, which on the surface seem like examples of speaking back moments, but might betray a larger set of invisibilities that I think Dr. Nakamura's earlier work has already kind of framed for us. And the first story I have for you begins, like all things fantastic, with Kim Kardashian. Right? Kim Kardashian is a fascinating figure for contemporary digital cultures because she embodies a digital identity. Because Kim Kardashian's claim to fame is that she is famous. Right? Just like if you ask anybody what the digital is, they are going to tell you that the digital is something that is digital. Her body is sculpted, but not original. And she herself talks about how she spends 3 hours getting ready to take prolific selfies and constantly producing images of her body, which are consumed by 47.6 million followers. That's more than the number of followers Angela Merkel has, for instance, on Instagram. Kim Kardashian simultaneously then becomes the most celebrated woman of color today with immense power, and yet allowed to be in public only for pleasure and consumption of the people around her. In a recent photo shoot in 2014 for Paper Magazine, she shot this series of pictures which were supposed to hashtag break the internet. The moment was heralded as the superpower of a woman of color and her capacity to accrue traffic to an extent that it would choke and break the internet, which is otherwise an incredibly masculine play. There were editorials that were written, scholarship generated, and news media that amplified Kim Kardashian and the power that she wields in her capacity to break the internet. It was considered both a moment of breakthrough, but also a moment of speaking back to the narrated scripts of fame and fortune that we are used to when we think about the digital. It was also a moment where Kim Kardashian was critiqued for her pandering to the masculine gaze and following tropes of sexualized bodies as fetish objects in these photo shoots. In both these narratives, the idea was clear. Kim Kardashian was breaking the internet one way or the other, and that she was speaking out and reclaiming that space, exercising agency through her body and the way she manipulates the digital web. If we look back at history, which this photo shoot in Paper doesn't reflect on at all, we might have a different narrative of it. David Theo Goldberg, who's a South African race scholar at the University of California Humanities Research Institute, tells the story of Sarah Sacher Bartman. Sarah Bartman was a Khoikhoi woman from Central Africa who was sold in London and then forced to live like an animal, put up for exhibition in freak shows. The good people of London, men, women, children, were asked to come to a museum to come and touch her butt, grope her breasts, and marvel at the grotesqueness of the black African female body as a justification for why the African body is inhuman, subhuman, and hence something that can be commodified and turned into objects. Sarah Bartman lived and died in London in exile, and after she was dead, they decided to not return her body, but kept it preserved in a museum, along with images like that, which constantly kept on concentrating on what they call the largeness of the female African body. So it's not a surprise that the photographer who decides to then break the internet with Kim Kardashian's images continues to kind of use the same tropes of forming Kim's body, which is not a black body, but at least a woman and who is a person of color, and is kind of made to relive that particular history and narrative of a black woman's body and how it's presented, right? And this is not new. So people who know the world of fashion and supermodels, this is Grace Jones, the first African-American supermodel to ever walk the international catwalk runways. And the photographer who shoots Kim Kardashian now, his name is Jean-Paul Goud, who was also a lover of Grace Jones, was also the person who shot her debut portfolio called Jungle Fever, where he decided to pose her as naked, inhuman, ferocious, savage, and African. The same photographer in 1976 actually shot another black supermodel in France, and her name is Carolina Beaumont, to take the original picture called The Champagne Incident, where he again makes the black woman a naked object of consumption. But also not just an object of consumption, but a piece of furniture upon whose big ass the glass of champagne can rest. Right? She is in her nakedness and in her status as a pornographic object, happy to serve. When we understand Kim Kardashian not as a body in control of its images and its future, a body that is not breaking the internet but is actually broken by the internet, by scripting and inheriting and reliving the historical technologized presentation of black women and women of color's experience of power, control, and absolute authority, perhaps it gives us a different way of thinking about how do we speak back and what does the moment of speaking back actually entail. Because as Gayatri Chakravarti Spivak, a subaltern studies scholar, has really very poignantly pointed out in her work, all acts of speech are not acts of speech. Some of them are just mimicry. The second instance that I have for you is from a different geography and register. And I want to introduce you to a particular genre of Tumblr and YouTube videos, which are called Kand or Masti videos in India. Kand is the Hindi word, which can be translated, depending upon the context, into scandal or prank or fun, based on how you are using it. A particularly celebrated form of Kand videos is generally gender-separated groups of young men and young women, so never men and women together, but men and women in separated spaces, generally in shared public and private spaces, engaging in acts of close physical intimacy, which is otherwise taboo, both culturally and legally, in the ethos of India. Right? So in India, where homosexuality and its penile desires are still bound by penal consequences of arrest and punishment, the production of homoerotic texts is almost impossible. So if you are queer in India and you want to watch porn, you can only watch white people as pornographic bodies. Right? There is like no such thing as homegrown pornography, which is available at least in the visual cultures. So all adult fantasies consumed by queer people in India generally have Caucasian bodies, which then also inflect the ways in which queer subcultures are framed and consumed, excluding any form of identity which does not fit the larger consumerist lifestyle as proposed by the digital globalization. The despair of having an entire sexual identity and fantasy shaped only by global forces that valorize and fetishize sexuality as a technological lifestyle is a different story that needs another telling. But in this particular context, I'm very interested in the notion of the Kand videos because they are closest to the expression of homoerotic desire. If you see through this entire range of Tumblr accounts and YouTube channels, which I did, much to the alarm of the university administrators who were logging my registrations at that point, if you look at the kind of videos that are around and you gather the comments around them and the reposts, they are essentially about men, and they are anonymously commenting on the desire for this body in this video, as well as the space in this Kand video, which is not available otherwise in everyday practice. Right? Here is a space that's authentic, that's approachable, and localized, and a part of gay desire in the country. They are often seen as speaking out against the taboo in popular cultures, where queer desire is always only pathologized or mocked at. And yet, almost invariably, these Kand videos are accompanied by a hashtag, No Homo, that continues to both distance, dissociate, and dismiss the desire of the queer erotic subject. No Homo is continuously thrown both in introductory texts as well as in the response to queer desire on these videos. It is a strange form of speaking out, where as long as there is no name, no identity, no explicit desire spelled out, then that voice is allowed to kind of proliferate and speaking will continue. But if it is ever named, claimed, or celebrated as queer, then that voice will be silenced and queerness will continue to live only in these gray areas of gayness, where you can speak, but you cannot have a voice. And you can have a desire, but never claim it. And you can have actions, but never an identity. So I want to end my introduction to today's keynote then, thinking about the language and registers through which the speaking back and calling out happens, and how we look at the condition of agency and capacity of mitigating the risks of speech making, of protesting, especially when thinking of bodies that resist the heteronormativity that's often embedded in our contemporary pre-racial, pre-gendered, pre-sexual digitality. So I'm going to stop with these questions here, and I hope that this offers a fruitful framework, and I hope that you will now join me in inviting Dr. Lisa Nakamura to the stage for the keynote. But thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Nishant. That was a wonderful, image-filled, fun, playful, smart, intersectional introduction. I'd like to thank Nishant and Daphne for their wonderful work introducing this talk. I don't know if I'm very short, so I don't think you can hear me. All those whose labor made this event possible, who we can't see today. So today I'm going to talk about the turn towards black feminism, women of color feminism of the 80s. And I want to do this because I've had the benefit of seeing other people's talks and keynotes at this event, and it's interesting to me how many people have cited bell hooks and Audre Lorde in their talks. So Nellie Pinkross cited, in The Weaponization of Language, cited Audre Lorde, Shaka McLaughlin cited bell hooks, and I know these things have come up in other places. So given there's been so much attention to the rise of the alt-right, which is the right thing to be looking at, I'm going to talk a little bit about the rise of intersectional feminism using digital tools. Actually, I'm going to be talking about virtual reality, too, today. So I'm interested in the turn towards women of color feminists of the 80s. I knew that this turn had actually happened when I read the New York Times article on the blockchain by Stephen Johnson. So Stephen Johnson is, you know, might be known to some of you who've been around for a while as an exemplary cyber utopian. He wrote a book, Interface Culture, one of the first books to tell us the internet would make us postmodern and post-body. He wrote another book called Everything Bad is Good for You, How Today's Popular Media is Actually Making Us Smarter. This sounds so dated. But you know the turn has happened when even people like that, like total cyber utopians, are now really critical of social media as a monopoly. So now everybody knows. So in his essay on the blockchain, he explained how it was important because it would, quote, rein in those corporate giants that closely hold all of our social media. He says it's moved us away from Internet 1, the free and open internet, into what he calls Internet 2, an internet corrupted by concentrated power. So I saw this turn when he writes, quote, there's no point in trying to restore the architecture of Internet 1. It's a variation of the old Audre Lorde maxim, the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. You can't fix the questions technology has created for us by throwing more technological solutions at it. So when Stephen Johnson's quoting Audre Lorde, something has happened. So it's surprising to see radical black feminists quoted in regards to the blockchain. Audre Lorde wrote theory in her poetry and poetry in her theory. These were interchangeable modalities. Yet on the other hand, it's not surprising at all. Women of color feminism, Audre Lorde, Gloria Anzaldúa, Cherry Moraga, bell hooks, and other contributors to these iconic collections like this Bridge Called My Back, originally called this Third World Feminism, has gone mainstream, animated by state-sanctioned violence against black people in the US, by the rise of the alt-right, and spread virally by cultural figures and musicians like Beyoncé, by social justice fangirls on Tumblr and on Black Twitter. So I'm going to spend a little time talking about Beyoncé. Her album Lemonade immerses the listener in Black women's culture, struggles, and pain. It's very confessional, it's lyrical, it's very much like this 80s woman of color feminism, which was centered around experience, feeling, and the complexities of intersectional identity. So this narrative that she did was so grounded in woman of color theory that fans actually didn't really understand it. So people created a syllabus crowdsourced by public intellectuals and Black women academics to help listeners understand what she was trying to say. So the syllabus contains classic and contemporary woman of color texts. Here's a story about it. It was very, very popular. I think it really surprised the people who made it. Candace Benbow was one of those. And it's an open access syllabus. So putting these works from the 80s, a lot of them out there in the public, both gestures towards higher education, the need for us to understand these things which are affecting us, but also critiques higher education, because the rise of future-destroying debt, which we've also talked about a lot, trading your future as the price of higher education, is a means by which women of color are driven into poverty. So it really does affect certain people more than others. So the syllabus was created because we need this knowledge now. And I say we, I really do mean all of us, during a moment of rising fascism, misogyny, and racism in the US. It's clear that post-feminist and post-racial discourse, the idea that women and people of color no longer need tactics and strategies of resistance, now that racism and sexism have retreated from discourse and now reside solely within social and economic structures of equality, as if that were nothing, that's behind us, that's gone. So women of color feminism has roots in the 80s and 90s, just like the popular internet, and just like virtual reality. So while many people have given up on Internet One, virtual reality and women of color feminism seem to be exploding. So I like this. FlavorWire is like a popular website, and even they are talking about Audre Lorde now. So 2017 marked the beginning of what Unity marketing director Clive Downey terms the when, not if scenario for global mobile VR AR usage. He also writes that the only thing holding it back is a shortage of content. There's lots of hardware everywhere. There's a VR land grab among every company that seems to want to stake their claim, and I'm going to be talking about Google. So this very much is the 90s as well. In this talk, I'm going to analyze two VR titles about women of color, one by women of color and one about women of color. One of them very much recapitulates Nishant's invoking of Sarah Bartman, so I'm glad that came up. And describe how VR's immersive qualities seem to present a technologized solution to race and gender by, you know, basically functioning as empathy boxes. So there's a lot of quantitative research that claims that you can actually become more empathetic to people different from you if you can, quote, walk in their shoes. So this is, again, very current in the game industry right now. And I have some reasons for why I think that's true. Life under Trump feels precarious, dangerous, and risky, and so does life on the internet. Audre Lorde's skepticism about the likelihood of white supremacy's tools and modes of control changing on their own, without intervention, sometimes very strong intervention, from outside, from people of color and women, applies not only to the social scene, but to the internet monopoly. So we cannot trust digital capital to regulate itself. We cannot trust white supremacy to go away on its own. So Donald Trump's agenda is very intersectional. He hates women and he hates people of color. Hence the need for intersectional feminism. As Gloria Anzaldúa wrote, the danger lies in attempting to deal with oppression from a merely theoretical base. Without an emotional, heartfelt grappling with the source of our own oppression, without naming the enemy within ourselves and outside of us, no authentic, non-hierarchical connection, again, very much kind of Web 1.0 language, among oppressed groups can take place. So the ability to enter into the lives of others, as Moraga writes, to trust feelings and personal experience, and to recognize our own amidst our differences are interlinked. So theory must arise from empathy, according to women of color feminism. It is, quote, our capacity to enter into the lives of others that helps make their lives and experiences our own. So as John Beller was saying, this is not an academic conference, and women of color feminism is not an academic movement. In fact, it's anti-academic. It was very personal. It was lyrical, short form, aphoristic, and really, really tweetable. So you do see a lot of this in Twitter. Audre Lorde, in fact, coined one of the most viral responses to Trumpism. The popular term self-care comes from her declaration that caring for herself as a Black queer woman was a political act. So this is from 1988. A year later, in 1989, law professor Kimberly Crenshaw created the term intersectionality and published it in the University of Chicago Legal Forum. It's called Demarginalizing the Intersection of Race and Sex, a Black Feminist Critique of Anti-Discrimination Doctrine, Feminist Theory, and Anti-Racist Politics. So intersectional awareness of race, gender, sexuality, self-care, empathy, the willingness to enter into the lives of others, a fierce commitment to political expression, engagement, interrogation of power, unwillingness to be dislodged. These are all tenets of classical woman of color feminism that really animate Black Lives Matter, which was started by three women of color and was very much an intersectional thing. So as I mentioned, Trump is an intersectional oppressor. He really does hate almost everybody who's different from him. He talks about African countries as shitholes, and he talks about grabbing women's pussies. So strategies for escaping this grab, for managing these feelings of vulnerability, of being cornered, are few. As Sarah Sharma described in her transmediala keynote from 2017, retreat or exit are only an option for those who benefit from the patriarchy. And so I was really struck by this image of a man whose face is totally encased by these goggles as the totem of sexit. So he's escaping from feelings of precarity and disenfranchisement precisely into the medium that claims to have a unique status as an empathy machine to help you understand different. So I was interested in this. So Sharma says there's no sexit for women. Sexit is just a man thing. And definitely no sexit for women of color, too busy doing things. So women of color feminism was never poised for retreat in any event, right? It's optimized for resistance, for precarious times, emphasizes embodied engagement, and engagement with difference. So I'm going to be talking about virtual reality's claims, which are in many ways mirror images or like evil twins to what women of color feminism is, to bring users into the lives of people of color and how that repeats identity tourism of the 90s, which I thought was gone but has come back again, this idea that racism and sexism can be reduced by VR or any technology. So this emphasis on empathy and intersectionality, on resistant practices through theorizing what Ansel Dua calls non-rhetorical, highly personal chronicles that present a political analysis in everyday terms have returned 30 years later, just as has virtual reality, which also claims to be non-rhetorical, post-screen, highly personal, and deeply engaged. So some of you might have gone into these six-walled caves in the 90s and thrown up, right? So, you know, I'm going to talk about that more. So in the 90s, the internet was so male. It was one of the first sexits. Like new technologies generally, virtual reality is on the same trajectory. So it's still interesting how many titles about VR are from that time, right? Back when VR simply meant any kind of community engagement or engagement with a person using the internet. That's what they were talking about. Like chat rooms, bulletin boards, that's what they meant VR was. So this is Howard Rheingold from 1994. But VR has always been gendered. The 1995 Nintendo Virtual Boy, actually their second least successful platform, it looks pretty modern, right? Resembles the Oculus, the Vive, and the PS4 products, both in the way it looks and in its overt references to masculinity. There's no game girl, it's just the Game Boy. The gendering of VR persists even now. As researcher Dana Boyd shows, and as other studies have shown, proprioceptic experiences of VR are very, very discriminatory. So is the Oculus Rift sexist? The answer is yes. In fact, women are far more likely to become motion sick than men are using this. Again, there's no game girl. So VR fails because women's bodies are more skeptical than men's. Their brains are more likely to only partially believe what their bodies are seeing. Both VR and women of color feminism are coming back with a vengeance because they validate differently gendered ways of seeing. If women of color feminism encourage women to believe what they felt and what they saw, to share these visions, feelings of oppression, to extend their sympathies to others unlike them, VR is its opposite number. This is why Chris Milk, who is a huge evangelist for VR, thinks it can cure our problems with racism and sexism. So this interest in basically fooling the body into learning how to think and feel differently is not new. It's a reprise of this apocryphal moment when the first film audience was said to have run out of the theater screaming when they saw the Lumiere brothers film Arrival of a Train. So film historian Tom Gunning has actually shown this is totally not true, but it persists. It seems to have resonance because it's a story that tells the power of immersive media to fool our bodies into something that they must believe. So Gunning called this a cinema of attractions because it's contentless. Again, like VR, you know, there's no good content yet. The spectacle is the reason for being. So woman of color feminism centers the body as a platform for knowing, as does VR, but does so by acknowledging the differences between bodies. This bridge called My Back contains a section called Entering the Lives of Others, Theory in the Flesh, which engages exactly with those questions of what it means to claim to know another's experience, the vital importance of women of color theorizing through the body and not in spite of it. So seeing as an other is the promise of VR. As I promised in earlier, as I described in earlier work, VR has long functioned as a virtual and real technology of tourism and escape for white people into blackness, female embodiment, as a touristic mode of pleasure and a kind of fake feeling of empathy. So VR is an escape from the body, an assertion of the primacy of male bodies, which can believe what they see a little better. And at this point, VR content is going to arrive in the home via video games, mostly, either as expansions or ports from existing things. So I was interested in Google's foray into VR. They launched a series of 360 videos called Immerse VR, which make a claim to fundamental difference from other audiovisual media. So here's some press about it. It was pretty splashy. They launched it with an exploration of racial identity. And here's another image. So you're supposed to move your phone around to see the different, you know, spaces in here. And interestingly, these VR videos are called experiences. They're not called videos, but they're videos. But nonetheless, like they're making a claim to total cinema. Right, the claim that Bazin made that we could see everything in the round and not have to see the things we don't want to see. We don't have to see race and gender. Rather, we will feel it. We will experience it as total, embodied, complete, and ultimately empowering. So, as I said before, critical race theory is resurgent for the same reason that VR is. If VR is a tool for fake sympathy, for believing what you see, Woman of Color Feminism addresses the needs of people who are left out of this post-racial and post-gender vision, or if they are included, are prostheses for racial sympathy. So what purpose do race and gendered bodies have in our newest, oldest medium, VR? How do the mediums claim to immersion and experience, the post-media medium, give rise to claims that VR is the new digital anti-racism machine? How are the politics of personal, and I'm talking specifically confessional identities, narratives about racial trauma working in VR? So I'm going to talk about a Black Woman's Digital Design Collective, Hyphen Labs, and Google's effort to be in this space of diversity. So Google claims that their media will bring you into the life shoulder to shoulder in virtual reality with Desi, a Black designer at Google Paris, and Clayton, who is a gay diversity trainer in San Francisco. So the claim to bring you close, to bring you shoulder to shoulder, face to face, into the life. Like they go into people's homes, they show you their kids, they show you their bathrooms, their kitchens, you're encouraged to rummage around and look at everything these people have in their homes. Are interesting, right? Because one is about blackness and one is by blackness, but black makers in any event. So both center black women who describe strategies for surviving the racialized media and other experiences of our times. But the Hyphen Labs example is really interesting because you can't control the point of view. It's a Oculus product, kind of, so you have to put the goggles on. But it takes place in a black hair salon, which is great. But you don't get to look around and own the space in the same way. So Google is a company that's been called out so many times, right? So here's the way they wanted to kick this off. Their motto, "Don't be evil," is identified with the systemic racism and sexism that define the tech industry now. So they've been called out for so many things: the lack of diversity, the way they've destroyed the neighborhoods they move into, the sexism of the programming culture. So it's no surprise when they chose to center racism, sexism, and homophobia when they launched their series. So this series is called Racial Identity: Exploring Race. And Desi's story, which I'm going to show you in a minute, just 2 minutes, frames an experience that is supposed to transport you across time, space, and racial boundaries and gender boundaries to bring you into the world of a black woman programmer. So before I show it, I want to talk about the strategy. Because Google's been called out for their incredible narrowness, their inability to admit in many ways what we all know to be true, creating this series of videos that bring you into the life of a black woman is both a kind of Freudian projection and a very canny way to say, I know you are, but what am I, right? So I'm gonna show it now. That's my mouse, I'm sorry.
Still worried about not fitting. I think that's my main worry. I'm still worried about being rejected, and you know, like professionally or anywhere I go, if I try to make new friends, I just still feel like either I'm not going to be accepted or I'm going to be looked at some sort of curiosity. I think the way it reflects as well in my adult life is for some reason, I've sort of transposed that to my daughter. There is nothing that scares me more than the idea of her being rejected by all of hers. And she's not. She's fine. But the idea that people could hurt her the way I was hurt is just, as a mom, I just can't accept that.
So in this video, and the clicking noise
always
is me...
I always have these signs of not fitting and not belonging. And I don't think I've ever realized that this was linked to my racial identity. And knowing that now, it makes a little sense. It actually makes sense if I look at it. I think that what's different for me, I don't have a lot of assumptions on people and things. I tend to question a lot. And that's really part of actually what I do as a UX designer, is that you don't operate based on assumption. You have to understand people, that biases will prevent you from understanding what they need.
Okay, I forgot where my own video ended. So this was a challenge to capture because it's a 360 video, and that clicking noise is me moving around to try and show the space a little bit. So this video describes the racism that this black woman experienced as the only black child in a small French village. The upper left navigation button encourages you to kind of look around this space, which is very medieval looking, while she cries and describes her fears for her daughter and the racial suffering of a black woman in France. So when she talks about how she feels like she might not be accepted, that I'm going to be looked at as some sort of curiosity, both invokes the idea of Sarah Bartman, a curiosity, an attraction, something which is out of place, something which is strange and exotic and to be objectified, but also as a curiosity, an attraction like the cinema of attraction. You know, in some ways, VR is still a curiosity. It hasn't become a mainstream thing. And when she talks about worrying about her daughter, This invokes exactly the reason why Black Lives Matter came into being, which is to protect the children of women of color who were being shot by the police. So it was always centered around the death of children by the state. So her tearful confession of her racial agony and alienation in Paris, while she's standing by herself, is then, you know, montaged to a shot of her walking into her office at Google Paris, and then the music gets very much happier. So Google Paris is an oasis of diversity. And later scenes show her eating lunch with Black coworkers who are wearing Black Lives Matter t-shirts. So Google is very much trying to connect this enterprise to Black Lives Matter. When I visited Facebook, the HQ Facebook, I was waiting to get a badge, and there were Black Lives Matter posters all over the, you know, Mountain View, the East Palo Alto Facebook headquarters. So it was an interesting move. I also want to mention that one of the other 360 titles by Google is called Favela, and that one's very popular too. So it's easy to see the Black Lives Matter shirt as a straightforward co-optation of intersectional activism. This is a promotional VR title that's really meant to reshape our experience of Google. Not our image, but our experience of Google. It's not super popular, but it's interesting. They have no comment section. And there's a lot of downvotes on this, right? So Desi's story, her experience as a woman of color, is recouped and made valuable and viable by her transformation into a marketable skill for the digital industry's UX design. So the pain and suffering of Blackness is converted into a valuable commodity for Google, because being a good UX designer means seeing other. It's an act of empathy, understanding through mediated experience. So her fear that she's not seen as a real person comments vividly on the paradox of VR. The racial experiences it offers seem to be real, yet assertions about grief, trauma, pain, and mourning by women of color in the real world are dismissed. So if you're a tennis person, you might have followed Serena Williams. After she gave birth, she almost died because doctors did not believe that her pain was real. Black women's tears are disregarded in the real world, but in this video, they're an engine for Google's empathy, a guarantee that its experience design actually works, that Google is depicted as the cure for this disease of lack of empathy. It shows how to capitalize upon racial pain. So the unwanted knowledge of exclusion, the body's exclusion, produces the empathy that allows women of color to serve others. Again, the Kim Kardashian thing, it's uncanny, to intuit automatically what they need. So VR that focuses on sites of Black pain or trauma have been critiqued for turning Black pain into a spectacle, a video game, and I'm gonna talk about this somewhat controversial, So this controversial project by Nani de la Peña, who is a VR producer, it's called One Dark Night. It recreates the 2012 shooting of Black child Trayvon Martin by George Zimmerman using some actual 911 audio. So she showed this at a number of festivals. Writer Priscilla Wald saw it, and she described the audience reaction. She said, "Most of the Black people I spoke to after had the same reaction. Why would someone want to create this?" White users, on the other hand, seem to be able to get up, move on, and go about enjoying the rest of the festival. And this mirrors very much experiences people have had going to the new Black History Museum in Washington. It's called colloquially the Blacksonian. You know, it's the big one. It's a big wait to get in. And the basement is full of artifacts of slavery, and Black audiences reported seeing white audiences taking selfies or running around laughing and enjoying themselves, while many of the Black viewers are just incredibly moved and traumatized. They're having a real experience, not a virtual experience. So this idea that Black pain isn't a video game isn't my idea. Priscilla Wald was thinking about this in 2016. So Desi's story invites white users into the experience of a Black woman's pain, witnessing her crying, creating a redemptive narrative of value-added empathy. prevailing sense of the Google workplace in the video is of wealth, refuge, and diversity. So everybody looks well-fed, happy, they're doing diversity training, they're, you know, well-rested. And they interview a number of specialists and diversity experts to talk about Google's sensitivity to difference. They're all paid to do this. So in contrast, Hyphen Labs is a collective of black female programmers who, like the women of color theorists I'm talking about from the 80s, don't get to do theory as their job. They all have day jobs that require them to do the work in the off moments, the moments when you're riding the bus or you're between a gig or your kid has gone to sleep. So I'm going to show you a clip from Hyphen Lab's work. It's called Neurospeculative Afrofeminisms. And I saw this at South by Southwest 2017. So I'm gonna talk over it a little bit because there's actually no dialogue. But I'll let you look first. This is their trailer. This project, NSAF, has multiple parts. So they have some beautiful wearables for women of color and for anyone, actually. Anti-biometric scarves printed with wearable faces that confuse surveillance cameras or cell phone cameras. Earrings that contain recording devices. And it has this VR experience called Brooks's Neurocosmetology Lab that sits at the intersection, quote, of product design, virtual reality, and neuroscience. So when I experienced this, I put on the headset and I saw this beautiful, animated, fantastical world that invokes the Afrofuturist aesthetic tradition from, again, the 80s and 90s. So if you're a fan of Earth, Wind, and Fire or George Clinton, their album art is here, right? So rather than making claims to using VR or, you know, 360 photography to reinforce the idea of a black woman's truth, intimacy, or empathy with blackness, NSAF places you within a futuristic black hairstyling salon, which is a classic site of community and care. Again, to go back to bell hooks, self-care is a radical political act for black women. Unlike Google's Understanding Race 360 videos, the user can't move the perspective, you really have to engage with the avatars that are in it. So the temptation to snoop around and look in someone's home, you just can't really do that. So even though Hyphen Labs makes no claim to provide truth, to make you feel what a black woman feels, the coverage of this somehow managed to see that as being what was happening. So this is from a BBC article that says the virtual reality that turns you into a black woman, which is certainly not what they're claiming to do. But there's other press that does this well as well. So Hyphen Lab's depiction of an alternative reality, an Afrofuturist experience, does exactly, I'm sorry, that so this experience of an alternative Afrofuturist reality has been misinterpreted as doing exactly what VR Immerse Google says it's doing, but it does a better job of doing it, right? So it makes you feel racial identity by occupying some black space, but it doesn't claim to turn you into a black woman. Okay. So in conclusion, woman of color feminism is a technology for surviving a world that was not designed for you, and I think as we're seeing at this conference and generally in our culture, the technology is not designed for any of us, or very few of us. So VR, like the internet before it, is a designed experience that excludes women of color and people of color based on the cost of access alone. So going back to the 90s again, I mean, it feels like we have these cycles every 10 years where the new equipment comes out, people say it will get rid of racism and sexism, and only a few people can afford it. Like the internet and the video games that continue to drive the sales of VR consoles, it serves and is produced by white male fantasy. VR's claims to hedonistic escape and racial virtuousness are spokes of the same wheel. So it's engaging with intersectional feminism in this preemptive way, anticipating, I think, what they know is going to be a strong critique. Bell Hooks t-shirts, there's a lot of Etsy swag for women of color, earrings, tote bags, the women of color syllabi that have come out of popular music, Audre Lorde quotes on Twitter, have all returned in the new post-green age of immersion because digital culture has produced such severe inequality. So we all need women of color feminism now. Poor white men whose jobs are taken by AI and robots, white women whose power and money did not protect them from Me Too-style work harassment scenarios, and others who can't afford to hope that the master's tools will dismantle the master's house. Thank you.
Thank you so much. This was exciting. It was inspiring, and it was rich. I think the audience is going to need a couple of minutes to process all the things which have come our way, and maybe some of you might find it shocking that you are actually allies to 1980s feminism, especially women of color feminism, without suspecting it. So we do have about 30 minutes for Q&A. There are two microphones which are present in the two aisles. So as and when you think you are ready with a question, and I do honestly urge you to think of a question as opposed to a comment, because then we can actually have a conversation going on. Please line up at the two microphones, and we will signal towards you to come up with questions and ideas. But in the meantime, I'm going to take the privilege of moderating. Thank you, and ask maybe two questions, which I thought were really fascinating. The first is this notion of postness, right? There is this signaling which continuously happens, and it happens more often in countries where they think that these questions of race and gender have either been resolved or have been arbitrated enough for us to move on, right? So I face it in German classrooms quite a lot, where I get young students who, when I talk to them about questions of feminism, they say, that's true, women in India need to be saved. And I'm like, but what about women in your country? And they're like, they're fine, right? Like, it doesn't affect us in particular ways because we are a post-feminist country, so to speak. This notion of affordance, right, thinking of the post as a retreat, as an exit, is something that I think had really strong resonances when you talk about virtual reality as also a means of a privileged exit from a space where you can afford to retreat. And in fact, coming from queer and Dalit feminism in India, one of the things that I was taught was always to say, you never retreat, uh-huh. Right? Like if things are going wrong, you never step away and saying somebody else will solve this. In fact, you put your body in conditions of precariousness and saying now deal with it in some way. But I'm wondering if you want to kind of lead us into this notion of the post and retreat and the question of affordances of bodies which can manage to do it.
Thank you for asking that question. I'm working on another book about social media gaming, and it was going to be about digital labor. But when Trump was elected, it changed a lot of things about the way I had to think about this. So clearly we're not post-race and post-gender because Trump has really put paid to that idea that was true. And following the alt-right's strategies and tactics, one of their primary modes of asserting themselves is to say that feminists now want too much. Feminists have got basically economic equality, which is not true, but that's often the claim, and that asking for more is simply asking for feelings, not to be heard. And feelings are often discounted as unimportant, whereas economics is very, very important. Yet they're the first to get angry when their feelings are hurt. So these multiple or mutual accusations of fragility are what characterize the alt-right and the alt-left, I feel. The idea of the snowflake is somebody who doesn't understand that we're now post-race and post-gender and post-feeling, and we should all move on. So I think, you know, the post-race was always a contested and controversial idea. I think that David Theo Goldberg writes well about that. Is his book called, Is Racism Over? Are we post-racial yet? The answer is no. Absolutely not.
Thank you. You know, I do have the capacity to speak for 30 minutes, but I don't want to do that to you. So please feel free to step up to the microphones to come up with your questions. Till then, I'm going to have the pleasure of getting Lisa's time and attention. So kind of thinking about the answer is no, right? It's a given. It's writing on the wall that the answer is no. And at the same time, the language doesn't really match up. Right, because how many times are we going to have to keep on confirming that the answer is no? Mm-hmm. Why does the question keep on coming up? You showed a 10-year cycle mm-hmm. where the question keeps on coming up. Like every 10 years, we have to ask, are we done yet? Mm-hmm. Like, can we do away with this politics? Is there a technological kind of cycle which motivates these questions and brings them into different kinds of contexts, do you think?
That's a question that I think people would have answered with Moore's Law. 10 years ago, they would have said processing power doubles every 18 months, therefore racism will get better and better and better as we become better and better and better at simulating non-racism. But I wouldn't even revert to that argument now. It's still the case that hardware does get better and better and better, but the political climate is not. So thinking back to John Beller's talk about racial capital, and how we're teetering on the brink of this absolute disaster. Mm. You know, a disaster of, you know, the earth itself coming to an end, but also people being pushed to their brink, being pushed to the limit, and frequently, you know, denied the right to survive, right? I think that woman of color feminism was already there in the 80s, and because now we don't look to hardware to solve the problem anymore, that's why we're seeing this return, I think. So I think this is a double nostalgia for a moment when resistance seemed potent and real, and also a moment of nostalgia for new tech, you know, the new tech. Like, VR really does claim to be different in a way that things haven't for the last 10 years. So I don't even know what to compare it to in a way. Maybe broadband. Like, people see it as fundamentally a different kind of experience of temporality or presence.
Thank you. I think the broadband is a great, great idea, because the promise of broadband was that distance will no longer matter.
Yes.
Right? And because distance will no longer matter, we will all be in proximity of each other's pain. Mm-hmm. And hence we will be able to become better people. Mm-hmm. Well, all we did was made better pictures of cats.
Yes. Or Pepe the Frog.
Yeah, or Pepe the Frog. All right. There's first question there, and then are you standing on the mic?
Yeah.
Sorry,
yeah,
the light's in my face. I can't see you. Yes, please. Can you just introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Shiloh Phillips. Thank you very much, both of you, for this contribution and for framing it also in this way. I have a question related to the way you unpacked the quote by Audre Lorde on the master's tools and the master's house, and also the parallel you made between this and the tech fix idea that tech problems couldn't be fixed by tech solutions. And I was wondering on your views if you see this as something on principle, looking at the issues of inclusion and exclusion, about who is making for whom, who is excluded, versus the issue perhaps being ownership. Is it the fact that it's the master's tools, is it certain tools, or is it because of the master's apostrophe S belonging to someone else? I was wondering if you had any thoughts on this, and also in relation to, say, queerness, which was originally a derogatory term that becomes something you can claim, we're here, we're queer. And so I was wondering, how can tools perhaps be appropriated after all, and by whom?
What do you think? Do you have an idea?
The short answer is I don't think. but I was wondering if you do want to take up. I mean, with queerness, it's a different kind of a ball game, because there is no, just like feminism has taught us, there is no global woman to kind of refer to. There has not been a global queer movement, so to speak. Like in different parts of the world, queerness has been a part of, or a subset of feminism, but it has also kind of been a critique of feminism at different times. I can only speak from the South Asian queer context, is that one of the things that happened with the digital technologies is that it actually enabled an articulation of queerness where none existed. So there were lots of practices of queerness, what would otherwise be called like men having sex with men, but not an identity for it. So in many ways, a critique of technology also needs to be kind of accompanied by a celebration of technology, because this was the first time when authorification, gamification, pseudonymous identities, different kinds of experimentations actually found a cultural space. And the only reason it found it, of course, is because neither the state or the law could identify it and couldn't figure out how to regulate it. It's changed over the last 15 years of the presence of the digital and so on. So, of course, there's a sense of ownership, but to use maybe a queer metaphor, there is also a capacity to queer conditions of ownership, right? That there is a certain perverted libidinal excess in technologies, which has been exploited both by either questions of emotionality or empathy, but also as questions of desire and of like this just gay abandon, if you want, right? And maybe we need to bring those kind of questions back into what does ownership actually constitute.
I like your question about Audre Lorde, because that quote is so common, like how do you unpack it? And thinking about the question of tools for whom, in every case, digital tools have been made for and by white men, and then they are taken up after many cycles of iteration by women and people of color. And so this notion, this house is already there, and then you've got to move into it and renovate it, or do something to it and find a way to jam yourself into that house, yes, it can happen, but it repeats that cycle of belatedness, which I think is very much about economics and about technical privilege. So Google shows so many black people in their video, I'm like, what? What are you doing? Like, we know for a fact this is a lie, you know? This is the virtual reality right there. So I certainly believe that black women, intersectional feminists, children, all kinds of people can use VR to do some great things. But I think the cost is prohibitive right now. And I kind of did this scholarly cheating by showing basically a industrial promotional ad versus a woman's art project and say one is better than the other. Of course one is better than the other, right? That's not really fair. You're always gonna like the art project better than the commercial. But there just isn't much black women's VR, no women of color VR. So the fact this exists was in the paper. So there was so much, excitement. You can be a black woman. And the ad said, or the journal article said, it's exclusively populated by black women, as if this was, again, something that needed to be in the news, as opposed to exclusively populated by white men, which is every other thing that I've seen in VR. So just the presence of women of color is a story in and of itself. So I think that can happen, like it has happened with the internet, like it's happened with other things, but it's not happening now, and it will be a struggle, as Audre Lorde continually says, it will be a struggle to use those tools. I think they will get used, though. Maybe you will use them.
Right. There's a question there.
Hi. So I'm interested in, it's like another Audre Lorde quote question, actually, about the idea of self-care, because my worry about self-care is that it's being coerced by, hegemonic structures in terms of, just taking care of oneself and not actually taking care of everybody else. So I was wondering if you would be able to unpack the transition from taking care of yourself and self-preservation into codependence and co-preservation, and making sure that that doesn't get coerced into, like, you know, a kind of normative structure.
I think what people don't get about self-care, and the reason I wanted to show that quote, is that she was saying it's a political act as a Black queer woman, not probably for everyone. So taking yoga, meditation, you know, stretching, standing up every now and again. What was it?
Lululemon.
That's not what she's talking about. You know, she's talking about it being a political act to care for those that no one else is caring for. So I think the reason it's coming back is that there are a lot of people who no one's caring for, and they're not all women. So this intersectionality was meant to be a very flexible way to incorporate a lot of different people. I'm super open to the idea that straight white men need intersectional feminism, and that they need care as well, because neoliberalism is not caring for anyone, or just for very, very few people. So you're right, I think, that it's this kind of neoliberal, you're on your own notion that, you know, if you have no health care, just go to the gym more. That's not what she meant, I'm pretty sure, in any way. So I'd like to put that quote up in its whole sentence so people can see the context of what she was trying to say. But thank you.
So my name's Ashley. Obviously, I've had various experiences living and growing up in a white world in Europe and in Canada as well. I'm now based in Hong Kong, right next to Shenzhen, which is the Silicon Valley of hardware, where they are poised to develop a kind of design centered economy to build the tools and the industry within China, and obviously in India is kind of a major hub for the skills developers. I'm just wondering how you see this potential for kind of emerging economies to start developing the tools and using the technologies or developing their own ways.
That's so important, and I'm glad you brought it up. Every device that I've talked about or shown was made by an Asian woman. I mean, every device was made by an Asian woman. She touched it with her hand. So that's always in the background of this, that that is the labor that makes these things possible, and it's cheap, immiserated labor a lot of times. So I think Shenzhen has been looked to as the site of rapid prototyping and nimble or lean development, where a small business or an entrepreneur can go and make something quickly and cheaply that's off the grid or very different from the mainstream products that we see around us. My colleague Sylvia Lintner has documented in great detail how often those are tweaks of what we already have, and they are designed mostly for you know, white male markets or white European markets. There's not a lot of design going on for developing markets, as far as I know, outside of the NGO space. So Shenzhen in particular is such an interesting place because you would think, you know, they're trying to develop maker spaces and, you know, bring in new kinds of voices. But I think the culture of entrepreneurship and prototyping is directly from Silicon Valley, right? So it's not just the idea of Silicon Valley, but the techniques and training and the way to conduct business, I think, is very typical of that place.
Yeah, it's obviously still copying the same Western logic, and they're, you know, using this, basically the same methods. I'm just wondering if you have ideas on how they could do it another way or themselves that is unique to their own culture and their people. I know they're trying to shift away from exports to service the Chinese economy and for Chinese audiences rather than creating products that go overseas.
Yeah. I think so many of the cheap smartphones used in the Arab Spring came from China. You know, they were very functional smartphones that just were not expensive, and so people have not paid much attention to that, that it really did enable uprisings in other places because they were coordinated so much by smartphones. But I don't know of any projects like that. I think they're possible, and it would be great to see some. If they were, I don't think they would look like this, though. I'm not sure what they would look like, but I don't think they would be around VR, because already every big company has a VR presence. It would be hard to break into that. But I think that's a hopeful question. So yeah, thank you.
One of the people I work with in Hong Kong, her name is Glacier Kwong. She's a 23-year-old person who's now the official spokesperson of the Umbrella Movement. So if you kind of go and look for videos on the Umbrella Movement, you will see this very, very young-looking person who's now suddenly talking about political action. And she had a fantastic way of thinking about what to do with the presence of women in materiality. Right? And she said, isn't it strange that your cell phone, which continuously produces traces, also erases all the traces that come before its moment of usage? So she says, what you need is a blockchain of usage. Yeah? Not just what happens once the phone is open, but what happens before the phone is touched. And all the biometrics, which is actually erased from your device, the fingerprints, the smudges, the blood, sweat, and tears, which go into the production of it, might be another way of subverting it, saying you need to be looking at traces which are erased as much as traces which are being produced by digital devices, which I thought was a very hopeful way of looking at it.
Yes, it's wonderful.
Yeah. There's a question there.
Okay, hello, this is Diana. Lisa, thank you so much. It's wonderful to see you in real life and not on the internets. I have a comment, I have an info bit, a comment, and then two questions. So thank you both. First info bit is that if you haven't seen it, everyone in the room probably should, Audre Lorde, The Berlin Years, because just how important Audre Lorde was actually for Berlin and for German Germanness, so Afro-Deutsche. I think it's important, everyone should see that film, and it does go into a lot of how self-care and how that actually had to do with her own cancer. Anyhow, that's an info bit. If you haven't seen it, see it. If you can't get it, talk to me, I might help. I'm curious about this sort of empathy, this notion of technology as a potential empathy generator. I, of course, would rely on good old-fashioned books and film, but I'm also thinking about, for example, how when Julie Dash's Daughter of the Dust came out, how it was received and perceived very differently by different publics, but how it's been re-perceived. But that is a kind of political and conscious empathy generator, immersive. How books, films can be immersive and be already, do that thing that that this VR plans will hope to do, but also lacking context, that's always problematic. And then I would just maybe like to ask about the role of interdisciplinarity within intersectionality, and that might point to some of the questions that came out of where does radicality emerge in innovation, and what types of things happen from the periphery. And for example, the kinds of films that Black Audio Film Collective was making before they had access to the technology to produce the ideas that were deeply digital and deeply technological. So
I know so little about the history of film. I just know the Lumiere brothers in a way, so I don't know what to say, but I think Julie Dash has come back for similar reasons. People need this, and it's not just people of color, but there are stories about survival, bare light. It's about what to do when everything's been taken away. There's community, there's being together. I think that it's interesting it's a hair salon, because that is a space of refuge, I think, for women of color, where there is a discourse that happens that does not happen other places. Even in islands of whiteness, you can find people in these particular places. The Desi story, VR one, Desi talks about her hair so much. Probably 20% of the time is talking about her hair and how French people don't understand her hair. They don't know why she puts it in a certain style and why they want to touch it and, why they talk about it all the time. So, I think, as you say, immersion and empathy are not about technology necessarily, right? But there have been modes of engagement that have relied upon the idea that there's pain, that there's feeling, and that it can be shared, and it should be shared by expression. So defending poetry, Audre Lorde defended poetry vigorously all her life, and that's the technology which people like, because you can tweet it. It's so good for these Tumblr-esque kinds of moments. And so I think she was critiqued in her time for not writing these long philosophical books, but it's been such a good thing for the kind of age of social media. So, and the Berlin Diaries, as you say, she's always been interested in intersectional, transnational, diasporic, all that.
Maybe could you, like, maybe when I, with the, for the interdisciplinarity, I think that's super, like, that's exactly one of those points where, when you talked about, like, Audre Lorde, how she was a poet in her philosophy and a philosopher in her poetry.
Yeah.
But, like, maybe something like, it's not just what you do, it's who does what for whom with what. And I would...
Yeah, this conference is the best conference in the world. It really is. And it's because in some circles I travel in, like, you know, ethnic studies, say, or American studies, people are allergic to technology. They do not want to talk about it. There's no good methodology for it. They're very suspicious. There's a tendency to dismiss it kind of out of hand. Yet that is where race, gender, identity are happening, and yet those disciplines don't know how to do it, and disciplines that do know how to study social media are allergic to race, gender, identity. So everybody here can deal with both of those things, like design, identity, it's okay, but I think in the academic world, it's totally untenable, like really, really hard. So that's why Nishant's work is so important, right? It brings together computational, identity, but it's still not happening. So thank you for that question.
Yes, please.
I'm really a bit, I must say, confused or annoyed by all this, because I think VR has absolutely nothing to do with your content, but that's maybe because I don't understand why you need to speak about VR to speak about your topic. So, because I like VR and I know the technology, I really don't understand you. So I don't know, it's a kind of problem I have now to understand you, because I think maybe you don't understand VR.
Uh-huh.
And I would like to have clearer speaking about concreter things.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I'm really confused now.
You're right, I don't understand VR in the sense that I've never made any VR content and don't know how to produce anything in VR. I think my paper was more about the ways that VR is being used to claim an experience of empathy which it just can't deliver. And as a way to say there's a colorblind technology which can let us experience what it's like to be someone else.
But it's great that it's colorblind. That means it doesn't look on color. It's a quality, it's a positive quality. It's neutral. Yes.
You
can use it for whatever you want to use it.
I think a lot of the panels on algorithms and politics were really good at saying that algorithms aren't neutral. You know, when we talk about news,
I don't know
clear.
Why. Yeah, maybe somebody else should continue.
No, I think that's. Thank you for the question, which in fact betrays some of the neutrality arguments that technology has always mounted through history. So, when French colonizers landed in Eastern Africa. And they decided that one of the best ways to quantify the human subject was to go with conditions and technologies of measurement, right? Because you can never really measure the soul of an individual. And anyway, the heathen did not have a soul to begin with. So they went with calipers, and they decided to put people's heads into calipers, and they did measurements to figure out the cranial size of the African man, and figured out that it's apparently the average cranial size of an African man is smaller than a Caucasian head, and hence it must be lesser evolved, so to speak. This is a neutral technology. Yeah, it was also colorblind because it wasn't virtual. I don't want to kind of step into a defense at all, but I do want to make a claim that one of the things that I take away from your talk is to say that a lot of the times when technologies step in with a claim of neutrality, they concentrate only on extensive measurement principles. Size, shape, cognition, neuroscience, mapping, and so on and so forth. And what, at least for me, being trained in theories and discourses and practices of feminism, one of the things that people of color feminism, people of queer feminism has brought out is to recognize that it's precisely the intensive measures of experience, of shared collectivity, of different notions of empathy, which are the spaces both of resistance but also that of exclusion. So that I could be measured, for example, by a whole bunch of medical sciences which would insist that I'm a cisgendered man. And whether I like it or not, that is the only identity that my biometrics, my passport, and my German residence permit will allow me to have. Right? That is an extensive measure of a neutral and a colorblind technology. And there is a need to bring back these other kinds of questions, which are about intensification of the subject mm-hmm. and her experience into the equation. So maybe that's where we need to meet VR now, and maybe you want to take it up from there.
Yeah. I think the claims of media over centuries to disappear are always suspect. That's like the claims of ideology to not exist. So when a technology says it can do something that transcends itself, like it can bring you someplace in a seamless fashion so that it now no longer exists, that's when you start getting suspicious, right? When mediation claims it's no longer there, of course, you should start to worry, because what are the reasons for its wanting to disappear? Like, what are its claims? Why does it want you to think that? So I think from an ideological perspective, VR is neither good nor bad, but I think the evolving identity through what the industry is trying to do with it, some of the content that's being made for it, is both a fig leaf for the rampant sexism and racism of the industry itself, but also a sign of things to come, right? When you see a new product being launched, the ways it's launched tell you something about who it's for, what it's supposed to do, and it's supposed to help you feel good about diversity. That's what it's supposed to do. So,
I've been told that there's very limited time left, so one last question and then we do a wrap up. Yeah.
Okay, so my question takes off from a quote by Audre Lorde. She says that every day we don't use our power, horrible things are done in our name. And I want to link that to the question to the master's tools, because the way even we've been talking about here, technology has been either an escape or, you know, something like a hammer. And I wonder, and I want to complement that by a comment Le Guin makes about technology, which is the vessel or the net or something which can hold something. And I wonder if we think of tools, of such tools, whether that might maybe, and that is my question, think of tools that are not not only about dismantling the master's house, but maybe that can also preserve something, especially if we're talking about mass extinction and so on.
I wish I had more time to talk about the Hyphen Labs projects, because they did make some amazing things that are anti-surveillance things using, you know, 3D printing and other things which could be seen as the master's tools. So I think the Audre Lorde quote you brought up is really good, that you have to engage, that there's no choice but to engage. So I certainly believe that everybody should be making things with these tools. And there are some sites for resistance. So I think when Lorde is talking about that, I think she's not saying we should never use any of the things that are made by white people or made by men or used by them, but rather to use them with a different attention and a different intention, which is to resist, to assert yourself, to survive. So I'm glad you brought that one up.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. Thank you for the really thoughtful questions, for bringing out the tensions that still exist, no matter how wonderful the conference is, between technology and being human. I want to end, though, on a positive note, because the first time I read the script of the keynote, I thought one of the most interesting thing was this going back to empathy, but not with empathy as a romance discourse, but one that we need to look at with a little bit of suspicion. Mm-hmm. Because Wendy Chun has this very provocative essay in The Dark Side of Digital Humanities, where she talks about how empathy sometimes becomes a form of retreat. I have felt and I have experienced, and now that's enough. Right? It sometimes is as minimal as a like on a Facebook button, where apparently our likes are saving the blue whales. Or that every time you share a meme, a child in Africa is getting a bowl of rice. That there are these are measures of empathetic cybernetic loops in a certain kind. And I just love the fact that you're coming back to empathy, but not with the romance of it, but with suspicion, and that there's a politics of hope that you find within that.
Right, there's nothing Google cannot use. They really have taken this notion of empathy on board. It's really interesting how they're trying to claim that energy, that kind of feminine energy, or what's seen as feminine energy. So thank you.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you.